Ashley.
Another question. Hugo Chavez has been in power, I guess, in Venezuela for almost 7 years, I think. He's coming up for re-election right away. I was just wondering if you have any idea why it's taken the United States so long to denounce Hugo Chavez and why he's all of a sudden this big guy, and like why it hasn't been like that for the last 7 years.
Because they thought that he would be just, you know, an anecdotal story. It would be something like he will just last for a year maximum. Okay, they have he has a coup d'etat against him, the recall of his election, and all these supported obviously by the United States.
There's a famous documentary about the coup d'etat and the role of the media. What's that called? Have you?
No.
Has anybody seen it?
Yeah, I heard about it, but I haven't seen it. The thing is,
what's that?
The revolution will not be televised. That's what it's called.
Oh, right. Okay. So the thing is that I think the American thought it would be just, you know, like a couple of years or a year that he will disappear, that he will not last. But it backfired. It backfired, obviously. The United States underestimated the power of the willingness of the Latin Americans for change. And you have seen that.
And it's clear that his constituency is the poor people.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, who love him.
And it's polarized. That country is polarized. I mean, there are some people who really hate him, and there are people who love him. Mm-hmm. And the majority of the people who love him, obviously, are the disenfranchised and the poor people who see an opportunity to better themselves, to change the system.
Mm-hmm. And in, go ahead, Andy.
I have a question. It goes kind of back to what we were talking about before regarding the internet and this sort of many-to-many communications. Although I should say as an aside, Alberto, I certainly am with you as far as the value of theater and activism. It's interesting how the Talking Heads action was a success. Well, I guess I would say the beauty of theatrical actions in general is that they're always a success, because there's never a need for 500 people to come out to the rally or for 6,000 signatures on the petition. These kinds of things that are fairly, would be more common perhaps, but really if only 50 people come out to the rally, then, you know, the media can look and say, well, I guess no one does care about this issue or whatever. Whereas the beauty of theater, of course, is that even with two people, it's a success because you weren't trying to get any more than that. I've done a number of actions myself, but that's sort of aside from, I'm interested in where activism goes, how much is created on the internet as far as, say, what we're doing, different chat groups. How does that, and I guess I don't really see it yet, at least, really culminating in specific actions. What I see is local groups meeting one-on-one. James and Ashley were both at mine and Shannon's place this past weekend, organizing things for the upcoming couple of weeks. The internet then serves, you know, in this case and on coming up on the 29th, as a vehicle to go on from there, but doesn't, I guess I don't see it so much as a real seed to create that togetherness. Once you have something going, it's a fantastic vehicle. And so I guess I'm just sort of putting it out there that I think actual organization still happens locally amongst, you know, finding activists that you actually know because you're, you know, getting together talking about the similar problems. I mean, the value of the internet as far as finding out what other people are doing and getting ideas and sharing in that way is indispensable. But I don't know whether I see it being the real nexus for people actually organizing on when it comes to specific actions and, you know, with specific targets. I mean, it's almost spread too thin in a way to have the kind of cohesion that you need to do specific actions in a specific area on a specific issue.
Andy, I recall when we met, you talked about one of your actions, something about rolling a barrel of oil over many miles, and so it was a one person action, and you mentioned that you got a lot of news coverage. Can you talk about that action or an action of your choice as a give us some of your own experience?
Sure. That one in particular was 2 years ago, April. And it actually came out of very much my own thought process, thinking that I'd read a Parkland Institute report about giving away the Alberta Advantage, how we charge, in Alberta, we charge less, lower rates of rent, I actually call it, but most people consider it royalties, then, and specifically it compared Alberta with Norway and Alaska, because these are similar states, if you will, to Alberta as far as oil and gas production, population, this kind of thing. And both of those places were sort of charging more, basically keeping more within their state for their own populace and giving, giving the petroleum companies a smaller piece of the pie. And I read that, and I'd heard a lot of things about pumping fresh water downhole, and I kind of thought, well, what does it take to be heard? And so I imagined that if a person walked around in a scuba suit for a day in front of the legislature, that someone would come and ask, why are you in a scuba suit? And then you'd have your moment, your 15 seconds to say your bit. And it just evolved from that to something a little bit more symbolic. And as I grew up in central Alberta, so I actually, right at the end of the school year, I pushed an oil barrel from the doors of Red Deer College out onto the highway, and then all the way, it's 150 kilometers to Edmonton and to the steps of the legislature. And, of course, did all the media things correctly and so on. I mean, people knew about it in advance, and the media was there that for the kickoff. And each day I did 3 to 4 interviews roadside. Some of them, of course, because it was a multi-day event, you know, I had an interview with 6:30 Ched, sort of Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I can remember being on the highway with chatting with CBC, and of course they would ask, well, where are you at now? And at that time, I happened to be about 5K north of the Morningside overpass. And so I said this, well, then for the next little while, cars were going by honking and pointing to their radios, because of course they were driving up to Edmonton and had just heard on CBC, oh, I'm just up north. They're all like, oh, I'm coming up to Morningside. Well, where is this guy? And another lady stopped brought a sandwich and brought me a sandwich and a bottle of juice while I was pushing this. I just had the drum on a dolly, but she said, "Oh, you must be hungry, and this is great." And it was the beauty of a multi-day action, because people, there was an intense amount of visibility. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of cars. On the back of my follow vehicle, I had a sign that said "Honk to vote Ralph out," because I knew that people whizzing by would wonder, and I needed to be able to deliver a message to them as they went by. But I also wanted to strip naysayers of their ability to naysay. Because if you go by someone on the highway, and for example, if they'd heard about me on the news the day before, and they thought, well, I don't think this SOB should be out there, you know, we love Ralph, and your only real option on the highway is to honk if you want to show anything. And so by putting "Honk to vote Ralph out," all honks were in favor of me, and there was nothing really that anyone else could do. I mean, if they honked, then I assumed that was in support. And so I kind of spun the reaction, but also allowed other people that wanted to show support to know that they could feel free to honk. And over the course of the week, there was hundreds and hundreds of honks to maybe 3 fingers. but nonetheless, it ended up being 13 days of coverage in total from the first time. I mean, whoa. My friends heard about it on the radio a few days before, and I did it as, I mean, I'm a diehard NDP supporter, but I did it as just a citizen action so that there wouldn't be any spin. And when I would talk,
but it's all about spinning the barrel and spinning the media. That's what you're trying to do.
Well, it was, but the other thing was I didn't want it to be marginalized in any way. And even when I was in NISQ, you know, I remember chatting with some rig pigs and chatting, you know, and they were saying, what are you doing? Well, Ralph's done all these good things for us. He settled the debt and all this. And I said, look, all I'm saying is more of the pie should be staying in Alberta. So I spun the message myself to be a very pro-Albertan position, just saying, look, we should just have more of the money here. Fine, whatever, Ralph, but Does Petro-Canada deserve and Shell deserve more? No, I think more should stay here. And that had universal appeal that really everyone could agree with.
Why is it that Alberta has such a lower rate of royalties than Norway? I presume in Mexico.
I can answer that question. What happened was that we had a decent royalty rate through the 70s, through Lougheed. But then with the crash of the oil in the 80s, which of course, if you talk to the conservatives, they would say was the fault of Ottawa and the National Energy Program. But frankly, it was a global crash. Politically was the timing was poor as far as the NEP coinciding. But when oil tanked in the early mid 80s, basically everyone closed up shop and jobs in the economy in Alberta just took a nosedive. And so when Getty came in 85, he dropped the royalty rates. He basically put oil on sale in order to encourage people to start drilling and to get things going because, you know.
Do you have specific numbers? Do you have specific numbers? Like,
well, I don't have the
20% or 50 to.
It went from 467 per unit of per unit of oil or gas from $4.67 down to $1.25, and that was during a time of real economic recession, and that was to get things going again. By the time Klein came in 92, oil was very much on the rebound, and certainly by 94, 95, things were, you know, the mid 80s oil was down to $11 and $13 a barrel. Well, by the early mid 90s, oil was at like sort of a $25, $28, $30 a barrel. So things were fairly stable, but those sort of sale prices never came off, and that's sort of the problem. I mean, Getty, I would say, did what he felt he needed to for the economy at the time, but then it was never in Klein's interest to bring those rates back up. And so while everyone else, and the study specifically targets 92 to 97, compares Norway, Alaska, and Alberta from the 5 years of 92 to 97 on their various rates, and as well as the Heritage Fund, and of course each of these three states is squirreling away the nest egg, but the other two are squirreling away tons more. I mean billions and billions more. And even Alaska, which is funny, when you're charging less, when you sort of have a lower tax rate, it's not taxes, but than an American outfit, then you have to wonder. I mean, it's the comparison is quite valid. The fact is that that our rates never came back up. I mean, I haven't looked for the last 5 years for where the rates are at, but our rates have never rebounded to what the going rate is comparing it to those other states.
You mentioned, Andy, that fresh water is being exploited and, in a sense, destroyed, pumping the fresh water into these wells to essentially flush the oil up to this closer to the surface where you can get it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a highly controversial use of one of the most valuable commodities, arguably more valuable now, fresh water, in some parts of the world, even than oil. Maybe I could use this as a segue to introduce John Veal, who I noticed was trying to get in earlier, and we went to you. John, if you're still there, and it's possible he's not there, but he's off on the on my right. Can you introduce your you're doing an applied studies in our work together, and on April the 5th, we should have a focus on water and globalization. Can you introduce us to this subject of how water is being exploited to in favor of oil extraction? The fresh water resources of Alberta are being sacrificed to advance oil exploitation?
Certainly. I guess the first thing you have to understand about water is that there's different kinds of water. And the biggest factor about water is whether it has salt in it or not and how much salt is in it. So ocean water, for instance, has a lot more salt than most sources of water. Now, all of the water in Alberta that we use, there's two types of water as well. There's surface water and then there's water underground in aquifers or whatever the case is. And because the water in aquifer comes from ancient seas or oceans, or generally, in Alberta is always a sea, has different varying degrees of salt in it. Now, using water that has salt in it is ideal, because really we can't use salt water for human consumption for the most part. And if you do, it takes a lot of energy to convert salt water into fresh water. Now, where I said there's different kinds of water, there's water where it has salt in it, but it can still be used by people. Or it can't be used by people, but it could be used in livestock operations. Or it can be used in agriculture, but it can't be used in other ways. So technically, as defined by the oil industry, fresh water isn't used in extracting oil. Because as you know, you need to superheat the water to steam, pressurize it into the ground to pump the oil out. And then that water replaces the oil. The oil becomes, what's left over is very toxic, sort of sludge or whatever. And there's a whole bunch of environmental issues with that, being mixing between fresh water and oil and all that. But the big problem is that industry gets to define what is fresh water. Now, so what they say is, well, if it's got salt in it, it's not good for people. But what you can do is there's very simple processes that can take water that is relatively fresh, that has some salt in it, and convert it to fresh water. But that water is still used in oil processes. So let's say you take, depending on whatever kind of oil extraction you're using, you can pump several, up to 10 barrels, 20 barrels, 30 barrels of water to get one barrel of oil out in Alberta. So Alberta, particularly southern Alberta, we generally have gas here, but Alberta isn't actually a jurisdiction that has a lot of water, at least surface water. A lot of our water is trapped underground, and that water isn't recharged very quickly, isn't regenerated quickly. So if we take all of this water and we suck it out of the ground and pump it into our oil to get the oil out, that water can't ever be used again. At least for several million years, it will never ever be utilized again. So the looming environmental disaster is that we don't have a lot of water. A lot of the water is used in irrigation. A lot of the water is used in all sorts of processes. So I guess what I'm saying is that we're talking about water and how, at least we're talking about royalties or rent or whatever on oil. The big problem is that the true cost of this oil isn't coming out, which is what the big issue is. The true cost to Albertans about using, getting this oil is that not only do we get a barrel of oil, but we lost 10 to 30 barrels of water to use, which is a huge problem because we don't have a lot of it. And the way the world is going, a fraction of 1% of the world's fresh water is being tainted, is being destroyed, is becoming unusable. And contrary to our beliefs, water is not an infinite resource. It's finite. And so this is a huge problem. So the segue is that on April the 5th, or is that the Metric concert? I can't remember. But April the 5th, I believe, is our class. And we're talking about water and the global commodification and privatization of water. So hopefully you'll all be there. I spent several weeks making videos and reading books that Tony gave me, and then he challenges me on the books, and then I have to go back and reread them, and it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Very interesting what you're saying, because within the context of water privatization in Latin America, for example. Nicaragua is, 3 years ago, I did a couple of months research on water privatization in Nicaragua. We were trying to do a movie, and we got some funding from the NFB, but we couldn't continue it. And we have a lot of footage where, you know, people were organizing in Nicaragua to fight against the privatization of water, because water, actually, even the underground water was being privatized in Nicaragua. And it's like Nicaragua is kind of one of the places where privatization and globalization and neoliberalism tested a lot of the theories about, you know, development. And so water, it became a huge fight in Nicaragua, because people who were using lakes, for example, a particular lake in central Nicaragua, which it was man-made lake. To make that lake, they had to displace a lot of indigenous people. Okay, and then when the lake was made, it was to create electricity. Okay, and so that lake, after it became a source of food for the indigenous people who started living around the lake. So, but that lake became privatized in Nicaragua. Okay, and so the indigenous people were pushed away, and a fence was placed around the lake. So lakes are being privatized, the underwater sources,
aquifers,
and the distribution of water. Okay, so there are people in Nicaragua who cannot afford water. Okay, they had to pay all their month income to afford water. Okay, so it's a problem. You're saying about the we're talking about Alberta, but also it's something that is happening throughout the world. I mean, the war water is in South Africa.
Well, the mobilization of political forces in Bolivia, which
Absolutely.
Have now culminated in the election of Evo Morales, whose real constituency is the coca growers,
mm-hmm.
and coca is deeply integrated in the Indian culture, as you know, of that part of the world. But it started with, as I understand it, in the late 90s, with a push to privatize water, and it was, you know, the famous Bechtel Corporation.
It was privatized, but it was,
that was
taken back.
In the process of privatizing, taking over the system and starting to charge for a commodity that, or not a commodity.
A necessity,
Yeah, I mean, you could imagine water. We need water. Water is, without water, we can't live. We can't, so is water a human right? Mm. Or is water simply to be a commodity available if you have money? And if you don't have money, what happens when you can't get water? So anyway, in Bolivia, this movement, and it was largely an indigenismo movement against the privatization of water. And then one thing led to another. It seems that, you know, water and oil, I mean.
Yeah. Have you read Blue Ball?
Of course, by Maude Barlow and Tony Clark. Yeah.
Absolutely. So that's going to be the next war.
Yeah.
The
wars of the 21st century will be over water.
Yeah. And air.
Air, we haven't commodified that yet, but is that on the...
For sure.
Yeah.
That's on the list.
So it's now 8:30. I'd be... and we didn't take a break. So shall we call it a night? The reality that the essays are coming up, and that I have for most of you, but not all of you, book reviews, and hopefully James Moore handed those back to you.
Yeah, I have them here.
Yeah, so getting those handed back is important.
Yeah.
And it's not too long that the essays will be due, and there's quite a detailed discussion of what you might write on or how you might go about selecting a topic. I'm leaving it quite open. I've got about 27 topics listed in the possible themes, but I'm open-minded about possible topics. I've written a 5-page essay myself on globalization, and I thought that might be a stimulus provide some ideas that you could bounce off of or react to in developing your own commentaries. Obviously, you're going to have to define a topic narrowly enough that you can handle it realistically in 10 or 12 pages. So it's that time of year where... the pressures become great, and everybody acts a little bit psycho from now to the end of term. I think it's sort of panic time. Anyway, we render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and we try to
we keep in the business of education.
Yeah, we keep the business.
Here we go. I have you can key onto the computer here. I've got a 2-minute clip here that you're all gonna find interesting. It's bringing us back to healthcare, and this is, remember Ralph Klein refused to speak about it because it was much too complicated to bring up in the election? Well, here's the uncomplicated version of what he's up to.
Is it on? Computer?
It was.
We had it.
Yeah.
There we go.
Sorry. Yeah.
You had it again.
Yeah. No sound.
No sound?
Sure, a small portion will have to be used to help our clients, but I assure you, they will receive only the cheapest medical care available. That way, the rest of your money gets to be profits. Millions and billions of dollars that would otherwise have been wasted on sick or injured losers are now free to flow to your insurance company's shareholders, even if they aren't in Canada. And when big foreign corporations make billions in profits, everybody wins. With the third way, we can make healthcare more expensive, less reliable, more exclusive, and best of all, more profitable. It's the way the U.S. does it, and I don't hear them complaining. So come on, Canada, get off your ass and privatize Medicare now. Because if giant companies can't make money off human misery and suffering, who the hell will?
Okay.
Okay. See you next week.
Okay.
If I can say one thing, I know that I just want to plug the rally that's happening on April 1st again. We'll hear about it between now and then. But Alberto, I don't know if any of your group, the Activision group, is together. But certainly, you'd be welcome to. Mm-hmm.
Send me an email. Send me an email. All right? Okay, sure.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, I have your papers here. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you very, very much, Alberto Guevara.
No problem.
Yeah.
I don't know all your names, so.
Okay, so that CD in there is yours.
Okay, your
TV hits.
Yeah.